knowledge and existence in such a hymn of life as only the stars of Pythagoras were ever conceived to have sung. To this concert there came all the arts and sciences, trivial and quadrivial, ancient and modern, in an orchestrated harmony that had first been envisaged by Joyce's master, Stefan Mallarmé. So that is a concluding statement of Finnegan's Wake, the grand scale of developing the idea that the poetic process mimes the learning process. And then I move along. He talks about Edmund Burke on page 149. Edmund Burke arrived by a single stride at the position that the cognitive process was also the creative process. Then you go on to, let's see, no more in that essay. Then you get to another essay, The Aesthetic Moment in Landscape Poetry. And this one says, a century separates Guy Battista Vico, who's about 1700. A century separates Vico's, who's making those noises? Banging around. I don't know why it's leaking through. It might be Jason. I muted him. I thought I muted him. He didn't mute himself. Okay. A century separates Vico's autobiography and Wordsworth's prelude, but they are products of the same impulse. Another century, and, oh, it must be you, Brian. You're coming through. Are you banging stuff, Brian?
Oh, there was a mild bang. Sorry, I didn't think that would have come through.
Yeah. If you're moving around, it's coming through. Okay. A century separates Vico's autobiography and Wordsworth's prelude, but they are products of the same impulse. Another century, and Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man carries the same enterprise a stage further. Vico generalized the process as a means of reconstructing the stages of human culture. There's those stages again, by the vivisection and contemplation of language itself. Then you have on page 163, McLuhan's writing about Tristram Shandy by Lawrence Stern, and he's also talking about Schopenhauer and the influence of Schopenhauer on the symbolists of the late 19th century. He says, Schopenhauer recognized in Stern, author of Tristram Shandy, not only a great landscape artist, but also a master analyst of the arrested moment of aesthetic consciousness. Now, here we're going to get into another part of the stage of apprehension, the arrested moment. But moving along here, here's another statement, page 165. Helped by Rimbaud and Mallarmé, Joyce arrived quickly at the formula of the aesthetic moment, and its attendant landscape is consisting in a retracing of the stages of ordinary apprehension. The poetic process he discovered, James Joyce discovered, and states in Stephen Hero, the book that the Portrait of the Artist rewrote, and states in Stephen Hero is the experience, the poetic process he discovered is the experience of ordinary cognition, but it is that labyrinth reversed, retraced, and hence epiphanized. Here's another one, bottom of page 165. And this secret consists in nothing less than a fusion of the learning and the creative processes in the analysis and reconstruction of the aesthetic moment of arrested awareness. Think of the aesthetic moment as people experiencing the now, being in the present. That's a popular cliche, you know, somehow tuning into the now and not worrying about the future or the past. That would be a vulgarization of the aesthetic moment of arrested awareness. Then the last paragraph of this essay on the aesthetic moment in landscape poetry, page 166, this peculiar fusion of the cognitive and the creative by an act of retracing the stages of apprehension was arrived at by Joyce as a result of the prior discovery for the technique of fission of the moment of aesthetic awareness. Now, that's a postgraduate statement. We'll come back to that. Okay, so these remarks are all made in the early 50s. The S.H. Coleridge's Artist, which I started off quoting from, was in 57, but McLuhan was talking about Coleridge in earlier essays, but this one is the one featured in the book. So we're talking about a statement that McLuhan is making, a theme, the merging of the cognitive process, the drama of cognition, and the act of creation. This is repeated all through his work. So did he do it in Mechanical Bride? And yes, if you go to page 75 of the Mechanical Bride, which came out in 1951, but was largely written in the late 40s, he says, page 75, thus André Malraux, the famous French intellectual, he did a book, Psychology of Art. So he says, thus André Malraux's Psychology of Art shows how the modern artist, deluged or flooded with the art styles of all times and places, thanks to archaeology and anthropology, was obliged for mere self-preservation to seek not a style, but to penetrate the essence of the art function and process itself. The essence of the art function and the art process. Exactly the same program is forced upon political and social thought today. Either we penetrate to the essential character of man and society and discover the outlines of a world order, or we continue as flotsam and jetsam on a flood of transient fads and ideas that will drown us with impartiality. So, there he is talking about, well, just read the next paragraph. He says, it is here suggested that the outlines of world order are already quite visible to the student of the swirling flood released by industrial technique, and they are to be discerned in the very way in which the flood operates. Edgar Allan Poe's sailor in the maelstrom saved himself by cooperating with the action of the storm itself, but it's spelled Strom, S-T-R-O-M, from the maelstrom. In the same way, we can learn from the art of such moderns as Mallarmé and Joyce analogical techniques, not only of survival, but of advance. Mallarmé and Joyce refused to be distracted by the fashion-conscious sirens of content and subject matter and proceeded straight to the utilization of the universal forms of the artistic process itself. There it is again, the artistic process and the learning process. So there it is in page 75 of Mechanical Bride. So I'm going to ask you guys, even though I haven't spelled it out yet, but let's see, what do you people think that would be? What is the bringing together of the creative process and the learning process? Maybe I'll add this part. If you go to page 32 of The Interior Landscape, and this is McLuhan's second essay in the book on James Joyce. Yes, the book opens with two essays, one more on Ulysses and the second on Finnegans Wake. So he says, on page 32, he says, the drama of cognition itself. For it is in the drama of cognition, the stages of apprehension, that Joyce found the archetype of poetic imitation, or the creative arc, creative act. In the state, what are these stages of apprehension? He seems to have been the first to see that the dance of being, the nature imitated by the arts, so nature is the dance of being, has its primary analog in the activity of the exterior and interior senses. Joyce was aware that this doctrine, that sensation is imitation because the exterior forms are already in a new matter, is implicit in Thomas Aquinas. He made it explicit in Stephen Hero and the Portrait and founded his entire poetivity on these analogical proportions of the senses. Then you go to page 34, and he says, one significance of Stephen's surname Daedalus, in Stephen Hero and in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and then in Ulysses, one significance of his name is that Daedalus, the inventor of the labyrinth, was accredited with having been the first to reduce the ancient initiation rituals to the form of art. That is to say, Daedalus was the first to grasp the relation between the pagan rebirth rituals and the labyrinthine retraces of the artistic process. The pagan rituals were imitations of nature because the soul imprisoned in existence could only be released by retracing the stages of its fall and descent through the various degrees of material being. Necessarily, therefore, all artistic imitation, so there's the creative act, all artistic imitation first arose from the pagan liturgies or mysteries. If Daedalus was the first to note this relation, Joyce was the first to see in these ancient rituals of descent and return the perfect externalization in drama and gesture of the stages of human apprehension. What are these stages of human apprehension? The retracing of any moment of cognition will thus provide the unique artistic form of that moment. and its art form coincides with its quiddity, except that the artist arrests what is otherwise fleeting. That's probably where I should end. So, that's another variation on the theme. So, Brian, you're probably the most informed on McLuhan. What do you make of this? What are the stages of humor apprehension that the creative process is simulating, miming, imitating, retracing? You got any other words to say about that?
Right, I guess. Just thinking, does it have more to do with the function of like what McLuhan meant by the tactile sometimes of the knitting together of consciousness out of the different sense impressions? I mean, they create their own space. There isn't a definite, there isn't an obvious way of translating or connecting or where your visual experience is, has a boundary, and on the other side is your felt or heard or smelled experience. The way that they are all knitted into a seemingly coherent or continuous experience of consciousness is it stages of that apprehension and then stages of understanding it?
Maybe, but you might be emphasizing tactility too much. The interaction of sensory data, what we call the five senses, but McLuhan said there were only four, and tactility is not a sense, it's the interplay or cohering of that data, that would be a drama of cognition. So if that's what you're saying, yes, I agree with you. That's the beginning way to look at it.
Bob, can I?
Yeah,
Bob,
go ahead,
what I'm getting from all the quotes and things you've been reading is that there's a distinction being made between the actions on or upon the senses and then the response or reaction to those. And the response and reaction to those are a creative process or can be a learning process and also can be seen as an unfolding of stages of apprehension as well. So that's what I'm getting from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the other part of this core theme is the title Interior Landscape refers to later art, the late 19th century, what he calls the second romantics, the symbolists, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, Laforgue, and their influence on Eliot, Joyce, and Pound. So they discovered the interior landscape after the first wave of romantics, you know, Keats, Shelley, and Tennyson, were using the external landscape as a key to art. So maybe I'll ask a few more opinions, but then I'm going to go into that. Does anybody else? We have Scott Woods here. I see we have Alyssa or Nate. You guys have anything to say about what you've heard? Maybe, Scott, you came in too late.
Yeah, I think so. I'll just listen for a bit.
Yeah, okay. I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago. My thought is how, I mean, this ties into some of what you're doing with Iandam. I don't know if that's being discussed tonight.
We don't bring in Ion.
Okay. Well, it has to do with how you're talking about the moment and the power of the moment and how you're perceiving that actual moment. But there lies a lot of mystery in terms of how you're interpreting that, how you're controlling it. What does it mean to control that moment or not? So I guess it has to do with how you place yourself in that process. And the senses come into that, but I haven't been around this whole seminar yet. So, but that's what comes to mind from what you were just stringing together, Bob.
Right. So what you missed, Scott, maybe, and Alyssa, is I repeated about 10 or more cases where McLuhan is saying that the creative process, the poetic process, mimes the stages of apprehension in the drama of cognition. which he sometimes calls the learning process. So that gets repeated all through the book. So that's important. So if media are extensions of man, and man is involved with this drama of cognition, then media have something to do with it. So I'm not going to go into what no one has pointed out. It begins with a guy named Thompson. Let's see, is it James Thompson? I'll just check that. In the 1730s or so. James Thompson. Yeah, poet. 1700 to 1748, was a Scottish poet and playwright, known for his poems The Seasons and The Castle of Indolence, and for the lyrics of Rule Britannia. I didn't know that, Rule Britannia. But McLuhan's always quoting Thompson's The Seasons, and as the beginning of people looking at nature and using it to trigger certain effects. So let me see if I can come up with some examples of this statement. The external landscapes, the exterior landscape, the world of nature starts to become used as the agency for an effect, a desired effect on the mind or emotions of the reader. And this is after the kind of poetry Alexander Pope did. It's called the Cutted Period, and there's some other styles, other names for it. But you might have read some Alexander Pope's poetry, where it's a couplet, two lines rhyme, then there's another two lines, and it's very straightforward. Well, poetry decided that wasn't adequate after Poe. And so they felt an impulse to do something new. And this was partly influenced, or McLuhan would say greatly influenced, by Isaac Newton. What Newton discovered in nature, its regular order, its clock-like order, really caused a paradigm shift and upset a lot of people and a lot of intellectuals or aesthetes. And Newton's essay on optics was a big deal. So you could say that McLuhan sees the printing press as enhancing, extending the eye, and so the mathematical organization of eye data, E-Y-E data, symbolized by the archetype of Newton, was an effect of the printing press, and the arts and sciences had to respond to this. So this dramatic change caused by Newton drew attention to the external landscape. Let's see. Second. On page 117 of the essay Coleridge's Artist, McLuhan lays out two styles of presentation and expression. He's always making a dialectic. And therefore, you know, they say McLuhan's a grammarian and rhetorician, but a lot of his writing is dialectical, at least maybe for a rhetorical or grammatical goal, but his technique is always dialectical. So he says, the dichotomy between linear and radial expression. Radial is, think of a wheel with the spokes coming out of a hub, central hub. That's radial. Linear is straightforward narrative. So he says, the dichotomy between linear and radial expression is not really as radical as might appear, but it has in such terms as continuous versus discontinuous, or statement versus suggestion, divided the allegiance of poets, critics, and readers from the time of Coleridge to the present, to the 1950s. It certainly had much to do with the intellectual divergence between Coleridge and Wordsworth, between Robert Browning and Tennyson, and between Pound and Eliot. In general, it seems to be felt that the Greek way of continuous transition in a poem makes for a habitable world of homely realities. whereas the Oriental way is inhuman in its austere demands of unflagging and unremitting intensity of contemplation and participation. In one case, the poet leads us through the labyrinth of his work. In the other, we are left bewildered to multiply variety in a loosely world of mirrors. Now, I've often quoted from his essay on Eliot and the two schools of the secret societies. He called them the Manichaean societies, vertical symbolism versus horizontal symbolism. So the Greek way is vertical symbolism and being left bewildered to multiply variety in an illusory world of mirrors is the horizontal symbolist school. So right after that he says, you have this quarrel among the theoreticians, say, or those, you can be poets and be creative but still write theory and speculate on the creative process. He says, in actual fact, this quarrel is pointless so far as art goes. In actual fact, the quarrel is pointless so far as art goes, since both kinds are inevitably dynamic, the Greek way and the Oriental way, following the stages of cognition, which are equally the base of religious ritual and human creation. Francis Bacon knew this very well when he divided the modes of human communication into magistral and probative, or popular and esoteric. And then he goes into the difference between Cicero and Seneca. The Ciceronian delivers knowledge in a concatenated form, having regard to its direct reception and retention. The Senecan, on the other hand, is less concerned with the reception and retention of any given body of data than with having the learner experience the actual process by which the data were achieved. So there's the stages of apprehension. The process is more important to the Senecan than the accumulated facts as presented by the Ciceronian. So the Ciceronian is concerned with preserving and transmitting an achieved body of truth. The other, the Senecan, with maintaining the process by which truth is achieved. This division embroiled the ancient world. In the 12th century, it recurred as the quarrel between St. Bernard and Abelard, between the historical method of the patristic humanists and systematic or scholastic procedure. So the historical method would seem to be Senecan, and the scholastic procedure would be Ciceronian. In the 16th and 17th centuries, it continues as a quarrel between the Ciceronians and the Senecans, or the ancients and the moderns. With Newton, however, the balance is upset in favor of the modern or scientific party. And despite the rise of the Hellenists, the arts, that's like the Greek area, the Hellenists, the arts in the main have followed Newton ever since Thomson's seasons. That is to say that Newton's optics established a... You go, wow, Alyssa, what'd you say?
Yeah, wow. I like hearing it so clearly attached to the Newtonian perspective, and that it's been perceived from that side of things. It's been majored on that side for a long time.
Yep. And I'm reading the essay Coleridge's Artist, so. Let's say this. Now think of McLuhan talking about matching and making. So the next line is, that is to say that Newton's optics established a correspondence between inner and outer worlds, a matching between the forms and textures of the world and the faculties of perception and intellection, which has affected the practice of every poet and painter since his time. This correspondence, once ascertained, it was possible for a Hartley to derive our inner world from the outer, or for a Berkeley to indicate that the outer world was the fiat of our perception and creative imagination. So Hartley is matching the inner world with the outer, whereas Berkeley represents the making, that the outer world was a making of our perception and creative imagination. This split between the physics of the self and the not-self, as is called by Wyndham Lewis in The Enemy of the Stars, helps to explain the differences between the early and later Wordsworth and Coleridge, as well as the aesthetic quarrel which grew up between them. Then he says, it tells much of the story of the Impressionist versus the Expressionist or Symbolist. And then here's a very interesting statement. I'm jumping ahead a bit. I got to go back and fill this in, but just since we're here, page 118 going to 119, listen to this. At the theological level, the Hellenic dualist, or that would be the Greek way, finds the quarrel insoluble on the assumption of the eternity of matter. The Oriental and the Romantic monist simply fuses inner and outer, master and spirit, seeking an H-bomb formula of annihilation for ego and existence alike. See, that's the getting lost in the multiple variety and illusory world of mirrors. Now, isn't it interesting that McLuhan is writing this stuff? No one knows he wrote this, right?
Very perceptive.
Right. So he's talking about the Greek way, which he calls the Hellenic dualist, which has a problem because it assumes matter is eternal. And the Oriental just obliterates himself. That's the Eastern way of getting rid of your ego, seeking an H-bomb formula for annihilation of ego and existence alike. Now look what McLuhan says the Christian says. For the Christian, there is no problem. There's no debate. Since the Christian accepts the revelation that the world was made from nothing. Have you thought about that lately? Have you been noticing the world was made from nothing? Are you a Christian? I doubt it, if that is what a Christian is. I've not heard you telling Ion or anybody else, your parents, that the world was made from nothing, and you believe that because you're a Christian. You didn't know a Christian believed that, did you?
No way.
Full now look at this.
And regulations.
Not only was the world made from nothing, you also, as a Christian, believe in the dogma of the resurrection of the body. What? What? The body gets resurrected? I thought you just go to heaven. I mean, the body doesn't die? What the hell is this? It's 1957. McLuhan is saying, for the Christian, there is no problem. Is mainly no mind, since he accepts the revelation that the world was made from nothing, as well as the dogma of the resurrection of the body. But for the practicing artist, there is also no point in the quarrel, since works of art are not made from ideas or doctrines, but like ourselves, must come into existence by a process which is indifferent to the winds of doctrine. So we are made by a process that's indifferent to the winds of doctrine, just like art is. So here's McLuhan laying out the different theories of creativity and then saying, well, this has nothing to do with the actual guy who makes stuff or a woman. The artist makes things, I guess, from nothing. So then McLuhan says, yet if the artistic process must always be the same, if that process, which he's trying to say, is a miming of the stages of apprehension or the learning process or the drama of cognition, that is always the same. The conditions of art and the artist are always changing. So the formula is applied to different situations differently. Certainly Newton helped to change the circumstances and the matter employed by the artist. The problems faced by Coleridge were of Newton's making. So going back to the phase before that of Alexander Pope. So the next paragraph says on page 119, until Newton, the Senecans, they're the ones who advocated, I think it's called heuristics. You look into the process of discovery. You retrace how the thing was made rather than just memorizing the conclusion. The process of making things is more important than the actual stated fact that comes out of it. And by the way, that's exactly Lynn LaRouche's definition of learning, and that's how you make geniuses. You have them redo all the great experiments so they know how they were done and learn the process of invention rather than coming up with knowing the theory that was so-called proven. Yeah, that's the stages of apprehension, says Carol. Let's see. Until Newton, the Senecans had dominated the literary scene from Montaigne. He was one of the first essayists. McLuhan used to quote him, he owed a portrait of himself to his public. He was the first guy who kind of started talking about himself. This is the effect of the individuating printing press. So the Senecans dominated from Montaigne to Pascal and from Donne, D-O-N-N-E, to Pope. Their preoccupation was with the literary techniques for arresting and projecting some phase of the human mind. There it is, arresting a stage of apprehension. to arrest in order to project, and to project in order to contemplate. Like the inventors of cinema at the beginning of this century, they hit upon the technique of stylistic discontinuity as a means of analyzing or arresting a moment of consciousness. The movie camera takes 1,000 still shots in order to capture the aspects of a brief movement. The steel coupe, French, STYLE COUPE, acute, style or steel coupe, and the cutted period, that's the way Dunn or Pope wrote, attempted something comparable in the essay and the poem. But to have carried this art further than Alexander Pope was probably impossible. So this is what Newton changed. At any rate, the advent of Newton's optics diverted artistic effort from poetic statement to the use of external landscape as a means of projecting and controlling states of mind under the guidance of two major concepts. Now, here are the two major concepts. The first of these was derived from the study of the visual harmonics of the spectrum, which led to a revival of the classic images of the harps of Aeolus and Memnon. Aeolus, A-E-O-L-U-S, and Memnon, M-E-M-N-O-N. That's from Greek mythology.
You are connected in HD audio. Please record your name after the tone and press the pound key. The conference is in presentation mode. There are 9 parties in the conference.
Is a very simple version of what was actually going on, technically by the poets and painters. They were using the external landscape to create a specific effect, not just go out there and bathe yourself in the wind or have the seawater splash on your face and recover your body, so to speak, after being in a factory in a new industrial town. So, and to prove that it's more complex, there were two major concepts aligned with this technique. The first of these was derived from the study of the visual. See, it's emphasizing the eye. The visual harmonics of the spectrum, that would be Newton's optics, the breaking part of light, which led to a revival. What?
Yeah, I was wanting to make sure that was related to color. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, color, which led to a revival of the classic images of the harps of Aeolus and Memnon. In other words, the ear. There's somewhere in his letters, McLuhan says, the Romantics, what they were trying to do was just bring acoustic qualities to the new visual space created by Newton and the printing press. So think of, they're trying to balance off this new visual hypertrophy or exaggeration. So
is this exterior landscape relate to perspective? Because it wasn't
Yeah, it does.
Wasn't just portraiture. They had to go out and
And look.
And see.
And see. Yes, I'm going to get to that in a second.
Okay.
So if the surfaces of matter, what you could see, were varied prisms, that's optics, Newton's optic, a prism, explaining the way light bounces off the eye or whatever he did, right? Remember he would break up the eye, break up how light went into the eye. If the surfaces of matter were varied prisms for revealing the qualities of light, then the entire visible and audible world could be conceived as a species of visual music. So it's music, but it's dominated by the eye. It's visual music. Mm. So
yeah, he presents the spectrum of the rainbow as being like a musical scale.
Yes, but it's giving the advantage to the eye.
Yeah.
And this is part of the breakthrough of a new medium. The printing press creates new art. So the first new art was perspective. That's 14, 1500s. But now we're 200 years later, and the kinetic media is starting to come in.
Right.
The industrial, what do they call steam mills, the steam engine, not just mills, and the mechanization of wheels and pulleys and things, right? It's beginning of kinetic space. So that means the pure visual space caused by the book is going to become an art form. It's going to become the content of the new kinetic media, and therefore the content, which is the previous invisible environment, becomes a figure, a symbolic meaning. And this is what these guys are doing. They're taking what the perspective showed, the external landscape, and now assigning it an educative role for the perceptions of the masses or the audience, right? They're turning it into a tool. The medium is the message. This is the first application of the medium as the message, so to speak, at least since the printing press. So
it's perfect for Newton when you're saying it's after the printing press and getting more into the kinetic thing, because he, it really was a triumph of matching for him, to not just about matching sense impressions with some sort of, anyway, but the orbits, you know, calculating showing that there's a matching between that and a formula that can be apprehended in simple geometry and visually on a piece of paper, that's like really matching to the interior landscape, you know?
That's pretty, hopefully, Brian, you'll learn from this course and this seminar to speak simpler.
Are you saying the three-dimensional quality, like it's matching the, like the sense of the global village to the individual, like as they're viewing, they're getting more, like they're getting a three-dimensional quality? Is that what you're saying, Brian?
No, I wasn't thinking of it that way.
No, but, he wasn't saying that. Let's not get distracted by that.
Yeah.
That my present statement is Brian will become a simpler writer once he gets this missing part of McLuhan that he didn't know.
Okay.
None of you guys knew. so that's what we can project, an advantage here for Brian, because you don't know what you're saying, Brian, because it's too wobbly, right?
Okay, yeah.
Hey, you're half right, but heck, I don't know.
Wobbly is a good word.
Yeah, you're in the disorientation of learning. You're in the chaos of learning right now. New orientation happening here. The first is the acoustic space brought in, but in the framework of visual space. So that's that. Then the second concept, McLuhan says, is related to the first. And this one is, if the external world is attuned to the mind of man, so some effect is intended, then the whole of nature is a language, and the poet is a pontifex or bridger between the two worlds, between... It's down, Carol. What's the problem? Carol's objecting to my sound quality.
Yeah, better.
All right. If the second idea, if the external world is attuned to the mind of man, then the whole of nature is a language, and the poet is a pontifex or bridger between the two worlds. So that's beginning to notice nature as an artifact, if nature is a language. Then McLuhan says, the poet conducts a symphony of mind and nature. Yeah, that's all I'll say there.
Hey, Bob, that's interesting because we talk about the Aboriginals have not, that they did not notice nature. So because the visual printing press brought in would have separated us and we would have noticed nature as being outside or something else in our perception.
Yeah, listen. The nature becomes the content of an invisible visual space. On the collective perception by the printing press.
Yeah,
so nature becomes a figure. The primitive people never saw nature as a figure. I don't know. They mainly were acoustic and tactile. They didn't see anything. Yeah. They danced to it like kind of an ESP.
My point was that it's like humanity was trying to save its perception by keeping the artist or the poet in that bridge role, because they still wanted to be connected to it, even though now they noticed it as being separate. The poet assumed this role as the bridge, and that shows some wanting to get back to it not being separate, like that there's a bridge in place. Yeah, that's interesting. So that's the second point McLuhan's making of these two points?
I'm not sure if that's the point. Let's accept what you're saying.
Well, that's just my idea.
Yeah, because there was no poet. There was not a writing poet or artist or painter. There was painting. There was sculpture. And these guys were considered craftsmen. You'll hear this explained in my ongoing dialogue with Dennis Young, how the idea of an artist as an individualist person with special insight into the environment comes in the industrial age. See, so we predict there was no special culture hero as artist around just before this period. It starts to happen with the Romantics, with the Keats, Shelleys, and Byrons, because the printing press is now enhancing the individual. And there's this aristocratic sensibility that the poet and artist comes to the scene, brings to the scene, which McLuhan spells out in Mechanical Bride. That's a whole other theme. So if Homer and in the Greek period, in the Roman period, the poet was a writer but also a rhapsode, a chanter, a ranter, definite oral qualities. So if you mean a list that we're trying to preserve acoustic space, the speaker as dancer of words, in the new visual framework, there is a bridger there. But he's talking about there's a bridge between nature, which is a language, and something else, the mind of man. You know, it's then, if the external world is attuned to the mind of man, then the whole of nature is a language, and the poet is a pontifex. I don't think he means nature is acoustic space, if you mean that by language. And the poet is a bridger between the two worlds. What are the two worlds? He says he conducts a symphony of mind and nature. So it's between the mind and the world, right? Not necessarily the acoustic aspect.
But the world in that way, not being separate, like pre-printing press, would have been acoustic and tactile, correct?
Yes.
So that's
and
what
visual.
I'm referring to. Mm-hmm.
Remember, visual space starts to have an impact around the time of Dante, and that brings to the next theme. This idea of using the external landscape to have an effect on the mind of the reader or viewer seems to come from Dante. He was the first. But there's a particular way Dante did it, which wasn't so oriented around perspective, which comes in a few hundred years after him. So we're going to come back to Dante. But the perspective, the pure perspective of, say, 1500 to 1800 is going to be dirtied by the kinetic invisible technologies. So therefore, the dirty, pure perspective, you see it in Louis XIV. It's called Baroque perspectivism, where they would make amazing gardens, almost like an avenue for hundreds of yards, you know, perfect symmetry. That is going to be upset by the first romantics with what's called the grotesque or discontinuous or picturesque. The event or experience that doesn't fit into the proper visual, and even what Brian was saying, geometric symmetry, the accident, the quirky, chaotic event, this starts to get celebrated, and it's called the picturesque. So the use of the external landscape as a medium that affects the senses and mind of people is going to be turned into an art form under the rubric or name picturesque. The quality of maybe acoustic discontinuity. So there are slight acoustic characteristics, but it's within the framework of visual music. So it's still perspective, but it's a discontinuous, interrupted perspective. That's what the Romantics developed as a technique. So he says, McLuhan says, it begins with Thompson's poem, The Seasons, and then moves through Wordsworth and Coleridge, and they argue later about this. And then Coleridge, because the eye is favored, Wordsworth wins the battle temporarily. And Coleridge gives up being creative or writing, and he becomes a philosophical speculator. And they get into politics, ethics, and social issues. And Wordsworth does that too. But Coleridge is in a weak position because there's still the favoring of the visual music, not the acoustic aspects of discontinuity that was emphasized in Coleridge. But McLuhan's whole thesis in this book and these early essays is that Coleridge wins in the long run, because his acoustic and discontinuous aspects are favored in the electric age. Wordsworth pales in the 20th century and is no longer relevant. He's too much visual music, too much eye, and the acoustic qualities of Coleridge come storming back, and he becomes the inspiration for Eliot, Pound, and Joyce through the symbolists. Now, here's what the interesting sequence. You get Coleridge, who is not relevant for a couple of decades. But then comes along Edgar Allan Poe, who is a journalist and has to write his columns and stories knowing the outcome because he's serializing in the newspaper. So he develops this revolutionary idea that the poet has to make a certain kind of effect, and everything goes back to how to make the effect. So he retraces the steps of the crime, which is, you know, the solution of the crime is the effect in the end. So he invents detective fiction, as well as a poem which has a certain effect in mind. Now, he's not doing it with the external landscape in mind. That's already the first romantic. He starts to see the new urban landscape as somehow creating an effect. So Poe is inspired by Coleridge, and Poe inspires Baudelaire, which inspires Rambo and Mallarmé and the second wave of romantics called the Symbolists. And that inspires Eliot, Pound, and Joyce. And then Joyce discovers Mallarmé, and Mallarmé is part of the Symbolists, and he's inspired in there. So I forgot to say him. There's Baudelaire, Rambo, and Mallarmé. Those guys have taken the charisma of the arts to France, and Victorian England is becoming weak in terms of the art. They were strong with the first wave of symbolists. Their picturesque art, Turner, Constable, and Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Tennyson, were powerful. But after them, we're starting to move into the telegraph effect, and something else is required, and Poe, via Coleridge, comes up with the answer, so the French guys, they become where it's at in poetry, and they're going to not take the external landscape as the means or medium to create the effect. They're going to take something called the interior landscape or the psychological or the weird urban landscape, no longer the wonderful natural nature landscape. They're going to take the dirty metropolis. And Dickens comes in here, too. So this is McLuhan's thesis, the takeover of the interior landscape as the medium to create the effect. They're still making art to have an effect on people, which began with the visual guys and the picturesque landscape. But the moving into non-visual, remember these guys, Baudelaire, Mallarmé, and Rambo, they're pretty rambunctious and get into drugs. Isn't it Coleridge who supposedly does Kublai Khan under the impact of drugs?
Correct.
You know, so the exploring of the inner sensory landscape, disrupting the eyeball, is the effect of the urban landscape, and photography, and the telegraph. And so you have what's called the dandies, these guys who saunter around rather aesthetically in the disgusting urban environment. They're trying to see there's something useful in it, aesthetically. So McLuhan is going to point out how the city becomes the new myth, the new creative inspiration source, which, you know, for the average Joe, the cities are pretty disgusting, pretty dirty and run down, and these factory towns are around it. And it's not that attractive, but the artist is always looking at the ugly, the weird, to point out something that the people are missing, to actually create a sense of an ecology going on. So McLuhan's thesis is how Finnegan's Wake completes the transition from the first Romantics to the second Romantics, and then with a bit of input from Pound discovering the role of the Chinese ideogram through Fenollosa, these come together in the group I call the vortices, Lewis, Yeats, Joyce, Pound, and Eliot. They are now back in England. The action has now gone back to London after this dormant period in the late 1800s when the action had moved to Paris. But interestingly, Joyce and Pound are doing this in Paris. They're going to reinvigorate English culture, English literature and poetry in Europe, inspired by French poetry, but they're the Irish, the Americans. You know, Eliot and Pound are Americans. Joyce is Irish. The local English guys ain't too hip right now. They're bogged down in Victorian banalities. And the Tennyson was the last gasp, but he can't make the leap to the interior landscape. And McLuhan, he spells all this out into detail, which is what's incredible about this book. The Gutenberg Galaxy is, you know, vast generalities. But when you get into the details of the changes in art and science through, say, 1700 to 1900, this is all spelled out in the interior landscape. And in the end, the book is a history of 2,000 years, because he goes back to Cicero and Roman times. Then he talks about Shakespeare and Ben Jonson. But then he gets into the first Romantics, the second Romantics, plus the novelists of the 19th century. And then he gets into the 20th century and the American novelist John Dos Passos, and brings it up to himself as the hidden plot. This is a great history, a great, it's, I find, the best way to survey the Western canon, because it's broad enough and it gives you big patterns that then help you understand understand Meade and his work. So McLuhan then becomes the accomplished poet, completing the whole canon, everything, because he sees through Finnegan's Wake. Let's see, I'll meet this guy. So I'm now going to, let's see, does anybody want to make a comment? What do they understand at this point? You should have gotten a big insight, so how would you explain it to your mother? What did Bob tell you that you're going to tell your sister? Translate me.
Well, Bob, for me, not necessarily out of what you're saying, but related to it, is this understanding of a visual space and the impact that had on us. In the first nature environment, there's no over there, you know. Then comes in the second nature, which I would take as technology and say the alphabet, the first of that. And that creates a sense of over there.
Right.
And with
that
sense of over, with that sense of over there, that's the sort of the creation of the individual and the importance of the individual in relation to what's happening over there. And
the Maddie crowd, the mob, the tribe is now removed from the tribe.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the alphabet enabled us to speak about things that were not in our direct experience, things that seemingly important but were not happening to us directly. And that way created the illusion of a separation between us and our environment, and our environment as a technology. And that's what McLuhan is all bringing together. That whole dilemma is kind of what he, his work began awakening me to and resolving within my own experience.
Yeah, see, you talk about visual space, and I can say it's a product of the phonetic alphabet, and then it gets hyper extreme with the printing press. So, you know, Alyssa starts reading Unsigned Media or Gutenberg Galaxy, and she gets that. But she did not know of the role of Newton's optics. So when you start to see the arts and sciences and their content as the effect of the printing press, this book gives you those details that makes it you understand what visual space is as a product of the printing press, because you see how it created the first wave of landscape poetry, and then the second wave and the third wave, and then flips into the interior landscape. These details are spelled out in essays 10 years before he wrote the Gutenberg Galaxy. So he knew what he was doing already. He's writing to Ezra Pound saying, I'm going to, in like 53, I'm going to do this book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, and I'm going to lay out all these patterns. Because he's just written these essays a year or two before where he's actually showing the effect of visual space, but he's not using that term yet. So you see, Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media is him turning these essays into an art form. They're the content of the vast generalities of media patterns that Brian started off saying, what caused that change? Are you still there, Brian? Are you beginning to see the detailing what caused the change? People thought that McLuhan was a literary, visually biased artist. They wouldn't use those terms, but a conventional critic, not an artist, a critic, analyzing the content of literature, poetry, and painting in a traditional way, but there was something sort of new about it, a bit eccentric, but it was the effect before the cause. The cause was the Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. The effects were him spelling out the details before he told you what caused those details.
Right. After laying it all out as a critic and historian, I mean, it's that interior landscape book is great, and the condensed ancient quarrel is good, but man, I mean, definitely people should read the classical trivium. It's incredible, laying out the entire evolution of the quarrel of the back and forth, the Senecans and Ciceronians, but after laying it all out, literary critic style and being a literary critic in Mechanical Bride and all those essays that he then plunged into being a poet.
Right. Or a poet about...